Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich.
Yeah, we did. We multiplied. We needed more, but we don't need any more atomic power. That's for sure. We're in Solartopia here for another hour. I have the great Kevin Camps with me for the first half hour. We're going to talk about nuclear waste in Michigan and other issues having to do with atomic power. Paul Kangas is going to call us at the half hour. Kevin will be welcome to stay with us to talk about some major developments in solar energy in Maine, California, and Nevada. Two out of the three are good. Nevada is a disaster, and no excuse for it. So we got a pretty full show to go. Kevin's been with us many times before. Kevin Camps, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, Harvey. I'm doing good. How are you?
Where are you? Where are you right now?
I am in location? Missouri. I'm in Columbia, Missouri at a nuclear industry love fest. Trying to
what
that.
Is a nuclear industry love fest?
Well, I'm being a bit harsh. It is an environmental journalism conference, but the University of Missouri has a very active, I would say rabid, research reactor on campus. And in addition, the Callaway Nuclear Power Plant is close by. And so this is a stronghold of the nuclear power industry. And I'm here. David Lockbaum from Union of Concerned Scientists is here. And we're trying to hold our own at this conference.
You mean that the environmental journalists are pro-nuclear?
Well, it's actually a University of Missouri journalism school event, and they've invited a Society of Environmental Journalists folks from across the country in. And like I said, because of the influence of the industry, even the, what would you call it, the not the military-industrial complex, but you got to add academia in there on the nuclear. It's, there's a lot of pro-nuclear sentiment in the room, and in fact, tonight they're showing the propaganda film Pandora's Promise, and there will be a Missouri Coalition from the Environment for the Environment representative on the panel to rebut, but, you know, they should be showing a real film like Atomic States of America or Indian Point, but instead they're showing this propaganda film, unfortunately.
Well, I like Pandora's Promise because it begins with Helen Caldicott, and they try to make her look bad, but they can't. And then I'm second, and he put me in there because I say something about the F word, which I don't use, but I do make a statement for Solartopia, and then I say something about the F word. But the F word, obviously, when it comes to nuclear power, is Fukushima. So beyond me and Helen at the beginning, the film is utterly worthless.
Yeah.
So you can watch like the first 5 seconds and then take a hike. You know, I can't believe they're showing that film. It's such garbage, and it's so boring.
Yeah,
really.
It is. It is kind of laughable because they show footage from like the 1950s. You can tell it's really old footage of this great new reactor design idea that they're pushing in the film, which is such a weird mind twist. Because if it didn't work in the last 70 years. Why didn't it work in the last 70 years? And the film tries to blame the Clinton administration for canceling the project. I mean, the project fell under its own weight, you know. I mean, Clinton...
Which project was that?
What's that?
Which project?
Well, the Integral Fast Reactor is what they're pushing in this film. And it was a prototype that was being built, I believe, at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And then the federal government, yes, during the Clinton years, pulled the plug, but it was because it was such a money suck. It was a black hole. It was a waste of time. It had been in the works for decades, and it hadn't worked, you know. So they were bemoaning the fact that the money got pulled, and I think that's very telling. I think, you know, the nuclear labs like Oak Ridge, even in nuclear academia right here at University of Missouri, they love the gravy train. They get so much money to work with, you can't believe it, you know. And when it gets pulled, they're pretty upset. And it took the form of this film, kind of a protest of having their money pulled, and they want the money back. Where's the money come from? It comes from American taxpayers. You could pave the entire country in solar PV panels for the money that these people waste on these dead-end ideas.
All right, it's amazing. We're talking with Kevin Camps here from the Heartland in Missouri. I've always wondered about the environmental journalists group. I mean, I've never gone to one of their conferences or anything like that, but they seem to be pretty stodgy and pretty conservative.
Well, there's some great members. You know, Kari Leiderson, who writes for Midwest Energy News, was my moderator on the panel today. And tomorrow I'll be on another panel on Roger Witherspoon, who does a lot of reporting about Indian Point, but well beyond that, he's moderating. On my drive here, I happened to be traveling through Ohio, and I caught on NPR in Ohio coverage of the Flint water catastrophe, and Tom Henry, who's another SEJ journalist who writes for the Toledo Blade, was kind of the environmental reporter on this talk show and did a great job. So there are good SEJ people, I'll have to say that.
And how many people are at the conference?
Well, I'd say there were about 50 people in the room today, and we're going to have that propaganda film tonight and then another round of debate tomorrow. Another funny thing that happened was tours were offered of the research reactor on campus and also Callaway, but a former whistleblower who worked at Callaway, Larry Christian, who now works at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is on tomorrow's panel, and Callaway pulled completely out of the event. They are still having the tour, but both tours really barred anybody like me or David Lockbaum or Larry Christian from going. So it's a select group that gets to go on the tours, and my response was, well, I've probably been exposed to enough ionizing radioactivity already, so that's fine.
But yeah, I would never go on one of those tours.
What do they got to hide, you know? It's not really a heartbreaking loss for me to not go on the tour. But I think they're afraid of what someone like David Lockbaum or Larry Christian, who are eagle-eyed nuclear safety engineers, might see on these tours. That's what they're worried about.
Well, I have never been in an active nuclear reactor, and I make my intent to never go into one. I have been in SMUD reactor, the Rancho Seco reactor in California, but it was shut. But I could never ever understand how people in the anti-nuclear movement will go into active reactors. I mean, come on.
The first one I ever went into was the Phoenix reactor at the University of Michigan. I was 17 years old, I was there on a total fluke. I was just kind of along for the ride. I'd say to people, if you are going on a tour and there's always this debate about the educational value, what you would learn, what you could then convey to people, you need to take radiation monitors with you. One example, I went on a tour of the GE, General Electric Morris, facility in Illinois. It was an aborted reprocessing facility, thank goodness. It was fatally design flawed, and if it had ever operated, it would have massively released radioactivity to the atmosphere, because its filtering system was flawed beyond repair. So it never operated, but it still stores 772 tons of irradiated nuclear fuel from mostly all around the Midwest, was imported there. I took a tour there on an industry government love fest bus tour back in 2001, just days before September 11th happened. And it just so turned out that I was the only person on a whole bus of 50 people, government regulators from not just the U.S. but other countries, industry people. Nobody had a real-time radiation monitor, and all I had was a basic one. It was a handheld rad alert from International Medcom. And sure enough, there was a hot spot halfway down the pool, and my rad alert was going nuts. And I have the figure written down in my file somewhere, but people's eyes were bulging out, and the person in charge of the tour said, okay, we must hurry along now. He didn't want people knowing about that. He probably didn't know about that. They had handed out film badges, so you could maybe someday, but probably not, find out what kind of exposure you got going through that place. But it's for real, and we can't sense the danger. We can't taste it. We can't see it. We can't smell it, but it's there, and it's doing damage. So,
yeah, I never go in those things, and I tell people, stay the hell away. Don't go anywhere near those reactors. I mean, God, why would you do it?
One of the heartbreaking ones now is Chernobyl Eco Tours, they call them, or something. You know, they charge people to go to Chernobyl and take pictures of themselves, but it's a dangerous place. And if you step in the wrong place and kick up the wrong dust cloud and breathe it in, you could have just signed your own death warrant. It may take 10 or 20 years before the lung cancer shows up, but it's very serious business.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll never forget, I was at a conference in Kiev in 1996. I went to the 10th anniversary of Chernobyl, and they ran tours out to Chernobyl. I could not believe that anyone would go anywhere near that place. I was 80 kilometers away in Kiev, and I was uncomfortable. So,
they had wildfires right then. Remember, I was there too, and they had wildfires out there. And the tour bus, people who were in Pripyat, the abandoned ghost town, smelled the smoke, which means there was radioactivity in the air. Because every time they have fires in the contaminated zones, it gets airborne and moves around, and people breathe it in, and it moves further downwind.
Yeah, well, let's talk about something a little slightly less depressing, which is radioactive waste on the Great Lakes. So,
Kevin, you
have a piece up at EcoWatch, ecowatch.com, a great website that we frequent and that runs great environmental pieces, and your piece is up there. Tell us what's going on with radioactive waste on the Great Lakes.
Yeah, that article, and I just got another one published also at Counterpunch. And so the EcoWatch one was focused more on the Wisconsin situation, where the State Assembly, the State House of Representatives, has already voted to repeal a ban on new reactors in Wisconsin that dates back 33 years. It's a post-Three Mile Island meltdown state law where state legislators, in their wisdom in the early 1980s, said, hey, you can't build new reactors in this state if you don't have a solution for the waste problem. And also, you can't build them if it's not cost-effective for ratepayers. It has to be, you know, cost-competitive with other sources of electricity, or you can't build them. So the state House has now repealed that, but the state Senate has not voted yet. And the gist of the article in EcoWatch is pointing out that if they do pass this repeal of the ban on new reactors, they are really digging their own graves, because Wisconsin was on the top of the target list back in the 1980s by the Department of Energy for the Eastern National High-Level Radioactive Waste Dump. At the time, they were going to build one in the east and one in the west. It all got whittled down to Yucca Mountain, Nevada, by the Screw Nevada Bill of 1987. But you know, DOE is sniffing around the country again. They haven't gotten away with Yucca. And so if this repeal happens in Wisconsin, then they've placed themselves at the top of the target list by DOE, because they have granite geology in the north, a place called the Wolf River Batholith. It's a very beautiful place with just gorgeous rivers and forests at the surface. Well, they would dig a repository some 2,000 feet or so below that surface and bury the waste there. And another place is called the Puritan Pluton. It's another granite body, both of which are in the Great Lakes watershed. So if those dumps were to leak, that leakage would very likely find its way into Lake Michigan and then all points downstream.
God, that's a nightmare. So what is the process involved here?
Well, the repeal, unfortunately, did pass the state assembly, incredibly, by a voice vote. They didn't even take a record. There were some Democrats. The state assembly in Wisconsin is two-thirds Republican, and there were Democrats who spoke out very strongly against this bill. So, you know, kudos to them. But shame on the Democrats on the Energy Committee of the House that voted with the Republicans unanimously for this repeal. And there's a group in Wisconsin that watchdogs campaign contributions, and sure enough, those five Democrats, I think, on the committee had all gotten money from various interest groups, be it the energy companies or even the labor unions, who somehow see this as beneficial in terms of jobs. And so the place to stop this thing is going to be the Wisconsin State Senate, because if it passes there, then certainly the governor of Wisconsin is going to sign this thing into law. And I should hasten to mention that not only University of Missouri has a research reactor, so does University of Wisconsin at Madison. It's one of the ones that gets the most money of all from the Department of Energy, again, federal taxpayer money. There was one year about a decade ago that they got $30 million in a single year, and it turns out my colleague Alfred Meyer was running PSR in Madison at that point. And it turns out that was the biggest single grant given by DOE to any research reactor in the country, and it also was the biggest single grant that the University of Wisconsin got that year from any source. And so the tail wags the dog. Guess who's in charge of the University of Wisconsin, incredibly enough? The Nuclear Engineering Department. And they wield big influence at the state legislature, too.
Shocking, but it's not really a serious threat that anyone would build a new nuclear plant in Wisconsin. Is it? I mean, I can't. They just shut Kewaunee. I mean, right or wrong mind would go ahead and you'd kind of do that?
Well, that's the fantasy of the Nuclear Engineering Department at the University of Wisconsin. They think that somehow small modular reactors are going to get built in the state. What the bill would actually do in reality, and folks like Al Gaddix with the Wisconsin Resources Council pointed this out to the state assembly hearing, and it fell on deaf ears. It's going to put them at the top of the target list. They're not going to get any reactors in Wisconsin. It's not going to happen unless federal taxpayers pay every single cent for the construction, which is possible, but not likely. What it is going to do, though, is it's going to put Wisconsin back on the target list for the dump site, because they have what DOE considers ideal geology, these granite bodies up in the north, which happen to be in the Great Lakes Basin. So we would fight that as hard as we're fighting the Canadian proposal to bury radioactive wastes on the lake shores.
Well, what is the Canadian proposal? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we've been fighting that for 15 years. It's a proposal by Ontario Power Generation, OPG, which is a nuclear utility in that province that has 20 reactors. So it's worse than any state in our country. At one time, Illinois was the worst state. It had 14 operating reactors. That's down to 11 now. But Ontario still has 20 operable atomic reactors. And they want to bury, they floated this idea beginning in 2001, they want to bury all of the so-called low and intermediate level radioactive wastes from these 20 reactors at the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station on the Lake Huron shoreline. So if folks can see it in their minds, the tip of the thumb of Michigan goes straight east about 75 miles or less, and that's Kincardine, Ontario, where Bruce Nuclear is located, the biggest nuclear power plant in the world. 9 reactors on one site. One is a long closed prototype, but there are 8 operable reactors there. They've also been importing the radioactive wastes from a dozen reactors east of Toronto for 40 years, incinerating the low-level combustible materials incredibly with untold atmospheric releases of radioactivity out that stack. And now they want to bury the low and intermediate. And intermediate is highly radioactive. These are reactor internals, less than a mile from the lakeshore. And we were voices in the wilderness for more than a decade trying to warn people about this proposal. Finally, we've got some traction the last couple of years in Michigan, where it's bipartisan at the state legislature, at the federal congressional delegation from Michigan. I should hasten to add it's not exactly uniformly bipartisan in Michigan. The Snyder administration signed off on this Canadian nuclear waste dump. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality signed off on this nuclear waste dump. So did the U.S. EPA out of Chicago. And the reason I say all that is because these are the very institutions, the very agencies who have brought us the Flint drinking water catastrophe. The very same agencies, in some cases the very same people. who have rubber-stamped this Canadian proposal. So obviously, as Ontario Power Generation goes around bragging about their outreach to the United States and Michigan and all the sign-off they've gotten from the likes of Governor Snyder, it's absurd.
God, it's insane. I mean, the Great Lakes have, what, about a fifth of the world's fresh water?
A fifth of the entire world, and 84% of North America's surface fresh water. 40 million people in 8 states and 2 provinces, and scores of Native American tribes get their water out of the Great Lakes, including Flint. So Flint used to get its drinking water through the Detroit system, and Detroit gets its drinking water from the clean, safe source of Lake Huron. When they switched to the Flint River to save money, that was a state decision because Flint had its democracy taken away, and Governor Snyder put an emergency financial manager in charge of the city. The Flint River is highly corrosive. They didn't even treat the water with anti-corrosion chemicals, and it caused this massive lead poisoning for a city of 100,000. So they have switched back now that the world knows what happened, damage done to the children of Flint, and they switched back last October to Detroit system, Lake Huron water. The lead's still leaking, though, out of the pipes, so it's not over. But that's the thing is they're back to Lake Huron water as their water source. They're trying to filter the lead out at their taps now with special filters and drinking a lot of bottled water. But if Lake Huron gets poisoned with radioactivity, Flint's back in the hot seat, and so are 40 million people. 100,000 people with lead-poisoned water with the potential for 40 million people with radioactively poisoned water.
You know, it's mind-boggling. I just got to sit here in silence and think about the devastation that we're talking about and the risks that are being taken. And the bottom line is that, of course, this is being done by corporations who are not human and have no health impacts. And so when you have people coming forth to put forward these insane proposals, they're talking for entities that are not affected. We're talking with Kevin Camps here of the Beyond Nuclear. What's your website, Kevin?
Yeah, it's www.beyondnuclear.org. And if folks want to learn about the Canadian dump, go to our international section, and there's a Canada button.
And tell us about the piece you have up today at EcoWatch.
Yeah, it does touch on the Canadian dump. It really focuses on the Wisconsin situation and what people can do. And so what I've urged people to do is contact anybody you might happen to know in Wisconsin, have them contact their state senators at the state legislature. We can still stop this in Wisconsin. As you said, Harvey, they're not going to build new reactors in Wisconsin unless they can foist all the costs on the U.S. taxpayer, which is entirely possible. But if we can stop this this ban on new reactors from being repealed, if we can preserve it, that would be another blow to the nuclear power industry. You know, they control state legislatures. They control the U.S. Congress, for that matter. And they just do this stuff on a whim, it seems like. Although we have stopped this 3 previous times in Wisconsin, it was the first decade of the 2000s, where they tried 3 times to repeal this thing. We stopped them every time, and this is the furthest that they've gotten with this thing.
Well, we still have this insane governor, Scott Walker, in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, he withdrew from the presidential race because he was doing so badly, and now he's back to doing damage to his home state in all kinds of ways, yeah, including this.
Oh, so of course, he's supporting this. And Wisconsin, unfortunately, has a thoroughly corrupted election system. It's amazing. We did, however, shut the Kewaunee reactor in Wisconsin, and there are two other reactors at Point Beach that I assume must be getting near the end of their lifespan. Is that right?
Oh, you would hope. Actually, Point Beach, also Kewaunee, got license extensions for 20 years. So Point Beach is still going, two large-scale reactors. And it turns out this is all on the Lake Michigan shore of Wisconsin. And it turns out that Point Beach Unit 2 is the worst embrittled reactor pressure vessel in the country. And the second worst is Palisades in Michigan on the Lake Michigan shore of Michigan. So you've got Lake Michigan, the headwaters of the Great Lakes, wedged in between the first and second worst embrittled reactor pressure vessels in the country. And the danger there is a pressurized thermal shock could fracture the reactor pressure vessel through wall. You would have a loss of coolant accident, a core meltdown, likely a containment breach failure, and a catastrophic release of radioactivity, again, on the shore of the Great Lakes. And they plan on operating Point Beach for another two decades, and the same with Palisades in Michigan.
Well, God. Now, as a part owner of the Green Bay Packers, I should have standing for intervening up there, so I'll have to look into that. Update us real quickly, if you would, Kevin Camps, on Davis Bessie and the situation in Ohio. Do we have any news to report on the possible turning back of the proposed subsidies to keep Davis Bessie going?
Well, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio concluded its latest round of bailout requests by First Energy. So they are now behind closed doors to make their decision. I don't know of a time estimate for when they will do that. The PUCO staff already signed off on this bad deal. The PUCO commissioners, three Republicans and two independents, not even a Democrat on there, will now decide if First Energy gets $3.9 billion from ratepayers over the next 8 years to prop up Davis Bessie and a number of coal burners. The wild card that just showed up out of nowhere, for me anyway, I didn't see it coming, was Exelon Nuclear of Illinois involving itself in the process and saying we can beat First Energy Nuclear Operating Company's offer by $2 billion. And then Dynegy showed up more recently and said, well, we can beat it by $2.5 billion. So they're really saying let free markets work and we will do better for Ohio's ratepayers than First Energy.
Is there any indication that the bids from these other two utilities is going to have an impact on the decision here?
It should. I mean, Ohio supposedly deregulated, supposedly created a competitive market in electricity, and here are companies saying they can beat that offer. And it's really kind of shot across the bow. It's thrown down the gauntlet on whether or not Ohio does have a competitive marketplace, except what they're doing is they're considering just reversing all that, doing away with 10 years of supposed competitive development and just giving this massive bailout to First Energy to prop up these failing power plants.
But we would assume that the bids that came in from Exelon and who was the other one that bid?
Dynegy.
Dynegy would be cheaper for the ratepayers in Ohio, is that correct?
By billions of dollars.
And so you would think that the PUC would be obliged to accept these other bids.
Only the governor of Ohio appoints the PUCO commissioners, and so unless they do his bidding, then they're gone after their current term. So that's the kind of cynical dynamic going on. But yeah, if it's about ratepayer benefit, you'd think they go for the better deal. I would hasten to add, you know, we are not fans of burning fossil fuels. That's Dynegy's business model. We are not fans of Exelon Nuclear. It is a toxic corporation in all kinds of ways. And so we showed when we intervened against Davis Bessie in December of 2010, we had Dr. Al Kampan, the emeritus chair of the physics department at the University of Toledo, as our expert witness. And he showed clearly that solar PV all by itself in just five municipalities in northern Ohio on residential rooftops, on commercial rooftops, could provide the 908 megawatts electric that Davis Bessie generates. Wind power could do the same all by itself. So certainly a combination of the two. combined with energy storage, and First Energy owns the Norton Compressed Air Energy Storage Facility near Akron, renewables could so readily replace Davis Besse, and they could do so quickly. And it's just not happening under the Kasich administration, the legislature repealing renewable and efficiency laws. It's the nuclear and coal industry sabotaging renewables and efficiency in Ohio.
Well, let's hope we can beat it. Kevin Kantz, it's been great having you on. You're welcome to stay in the second half of the show. We're going to be visited by Paul Kangas with a report, an update on solar energy in California. We've got good news from California, good news from Maine, and insanely bad news from Nevada. I don't know if you've been following that. But you're welcome to stay with us, Kevin, if you want to talk about renewables.
Sure,
we're going to take
a
short break. Yeah, please do. And take a short break here, maybe hear the theme song for a bit, and come back and talk with Paul Kangas as well as with Kevin Kantz.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Okay, we are back in Solartopia. A short break there. Kevin Kantz is staying with us from Beyond Nuclear. Paul Kangas, are you on?
Yes, Harvey, I am here. You are here.
And we are here, and we are three together. Okay. Paul Kangas, you're talking to us from the Bay Area in California. Kevin Kantz is with us from Missouri, and I am here in Ohio. And our studio is in New York. So we have got we are transcontinental here, bicoastal and Midwestern. All at the same time. Paul, you are in California in the Bay Area. You've just come from a Public Utilities Commission hearing. There has been big news in California on the solar front. Tell us what's going on, please.
Well, there was a meeting of the PUC, five commissioners, and they had voted and passed a proposal months ago, December. And it basically said, we're going to require PG&E and all the utilities in California to pay solar homeowners 15 cents a kilowatt hour. And then yesterday.
Well, that's for, wait, now that's, they want to get paid 15 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity that's generated by solar panels on your house that goes into the grid in excess of what you consume, right?
Yes, yes. So
right.
You get free energy, and then the surplus you sell onto the grid, you get paid 15 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, that only actually makes money if you build a house with 100 solar panels.
Well, because then you produce more than you use, and you sell the excess into the grid, and they got to pay you for it.
Yes, that's exactly. Like that, there's this town in Germany called Wielpolsried. It's famous for producing 321% more energy than the town uses, and they sell it on the grid for $8 million a year.
And what do they get paid per kilowatt hour in Germany?
Well, the town, I believe, signed a contract either at 88 cents or 99 cents a kilowatt hour, because the farmers in this little town, as soon as the contract was offered at 99 cents, they recognize this was a gold mine, And so the town signed the contract for 99 cents. And the contract was for 20 years, and that contract started in the year 1999. So they get to go on out to about 2019 and making that money.
And who's paying the money? Do they sell it to a private utility?
They sell it to a utility. The utility then bills all customers. All of their customers pay 1% more. So all the customers, like if your monthly bill is $100 a month for electricity, you pay $101. So you pay $1 more. And if you're a aluminum smelting company and you're using $100,000 a month worth of electricity, you're going to pay $1,000 a month more. It's a 1% flat tax kind of thing.
Well, and only 1% is what's required to cover this extremely high rate for solar. It sounds kind of small.
Yes, that's what's called crowdfunding, where if you have the Kickstarter does this all the time, where they say, you know, put in $2 on this guy's project and you'll be able to raise $500,000. And people do this all the time. You go on Kickstarter and say, okay, I've got this project. I need $500,000. Will you please put in $3? And they get, you know, $250,000 people putting in $3, and so they raise the money that way. And so it's the same thing with electrical users. If every user pays 1% more, and that was fine because the Germans had just had the meltdown at Chernobyl, so everybody was very scared. I was over there when this happened. I was in Germany when Chernobyl melted down, and everybody was really panicked at the time. And they're still somewhat panicked, but they're successfully panicking because Hermann Scheer wrote a book about it called Energy Imperative, which explained how the 1% process would work. And he predicted in his book that we will shut down nukes by using this method. And his book was so convincing, the parliament said, let's do it. And so they built 1,000 houses, each house with 100 solar panels. And then the banks sold them to people who had good credit and jobs. And people snatched up these houses immediately because at 99 cents a kilowatt hour, the day you move in, you know, you're making $2,000 a month income from solar.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what happened today now in California?
Well, they allowed about 70 of us to speak. And my one-minute speech started out saying, we are in a world emergency. We have to throw all the money we can at solving this problem. And the way to do it is to copy what Maine did. The state of Maine passed a solar payment policy that requires the utilities in Maine, which is a U.S. state, everybody knows. But it's amazing how Americans don't know that Maine did this. It's not been covered by the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times or anything that Maine has done this. And so I started out talking about how Maine passed it for 33 cents, and that's the break-even point, and we have to do that because if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to shift California to 100% solar and wind and water, and that it's inevitable that we must shift to solar, and so that's why the PUC needs to require the utilities to pay 33 cents a kilowatt hour. That was my argument. I've been arguing that for 7 years, and I've been petitioning for 7 years for this. Now, we turned in 8,000 signatures so far. We turned another stack of signatures in today to their executive secretary.
What does it ask for? What does the petition ask for that you've turned in?
It asks for 33 cents a kilowatt hour.
Okay, to match Maine, not 99 like Germany.
No, when we started the petition 7 years ago, we were asking for it. We were explaining what happened in Germany. But people, ordinary people gave us a flack about that high rate. And they said, that's Germany, you know, those people are crazy, can't do that. So then we lowered it to 49 cents to sort of celebrate the 49er gold rush and the 49er sports team out here. We thought that would catch on by using the 49 gold rush idea, and that didn't catch on very hot either. So we lowered it down to 33 cents when Maine passed theirs. So
okay.
We have 8,000 signatures, including Bill McKibben, Ralph Nader, a lot of very interesting, famous people have signed it. Bianca Jagger. So we get support on this issue. Oh, I think Harvey Wasserman signed it too. Some guy named Harvey Wasserman. His name's right.
He'll sign anything. Okay, so now the question is, where do we stand with the California law? What is the number that California is paying? You said it's 15 cents a kilowatt hour?
15 cents a kilowatt hour, yes.
So the under this ruling that has been confirmed today, as we speak, by the California Public Utilities Commission, if you have
yes.
solar panels on your house in California and you have excess power and you put it into the grid, you get 15 cents a kilowatt hour?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, but now the question then is, does that apply to the LADWP, to the Department of Water and Power in L.A.?
Ooh, that's a good question. You should have been there to ask that question. That's brilliant. Nobody asked that question. It does
because they
require,
are a public-owned utility.
Yeah, they are a public-owned. Yes, it would apply to them. They're within the state of California. Yes. As an attorney, I can tell you yes. That
now,
law
when
would
do you,
cover them.
All right, and when do you get this money? Because they play games in L.A. But my understanding is if you sell solar to the LADWP, they give you a credit, and you can only collect the credit at certain points. They don't give it to you, like, on your monthly bill. Is that right?
See, in Herman Scheer's book, he has a whole chapter on the fact that they cannot set a cap on the number of solar panels that you have because you have to be able to generate as much energy as you can afford to invest in. So if you want to put 100 solar panels on your house, you have to be able. That's why Germany built all these houses with 100 solar panels, because it was a magic number. It was the number that would give you four times as much energy as you need, and you'd be able to sell the surplus onto the grid, so you would help Germany reach their inevitable goal of 100% renewable. But there has to be an unlimited amount. It has to be unlimited. They can't set a lid. I mean, if you're a corporation and you build a giant solar farm with 1,000 solar panels, can they tell you, no, you can't do that? I don't think so.
Well, they can in Los Angeles. I confronted this because we have a house in L.A., which we're moving to, hopefully sooner rather than later. And I had Solar City come out, and they told me that they could only install, and installers are licensed in California. They can only install panels based on a certain percentage of my usage, and that
yes,
I could not put 100% of the capacity of the house. I could only put 100% of my usage, which really pissed me off. And
that was yesterday. Today it's a different world.
So this new bill says that they cannot restrict you from how much solar you want to put on your house?
Yes.
Well, that's fucking great. Yeah, this is, by the way, internet radio, so I can use the F word. That's Fukushima great. By God.
That's Fukushima.
Yeah, well, I say that because Kevin, who's on the line. Kevin, you're there, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so Kevin is going to be seeing the movie Pandora's Promise, which is ridiculous, but I am in the front of it with Helen Caldicott, and I talk about using the F word, which is why he put me in the film, because he thinks it made me look bad. But, of course, the F word is, and when it comes to the nukes, is Fukushima. So what you're saying now is that this law, this Public Utilities Commission ruling, says that they cannot restrict you from putting however much solar panels on your house that you want to do? Is that your understanding of the new regulation?
Yes. They might be able to require you to get an IOU, which is a permit, a license, to be an independent operator utility after you reach a certain level of panels.
Uh-huh.
But that's okay. I mean, these people who put up 1,000 panels have to get one of those licenses.
Well, I don't know how many I'd be able to put on my house in L.A., but it's more than they were going to give me, that's for sure. And I was prepared to go. I wanted to take the LADWP to court and have it go to the Supreme Court so we could have a case that would be Wasserman versus LADWP. And I was going to make sure that if I signed on anybody else to the court case, that their name would begin with Y or Z, so that mine would be first and my name would be on the case. But you're telling me now that I won't have to do that.
No, I think you should still do that, because that is exactly what happens with legislation. There is a clause in all states called the cleanup doctrine, where legislation is passed and there's a bit of confusion, and you're raising an interesting point about, what if I put 100 solar panel array out behind my house, like a giant fence or a billboard? Well, I've got this one friend in Long Beach who's got two houses next to each other, and he is right now, we're in the middle of laying it out and putting up 100 solar panels on his house. His name is Peter Matthews. You know him.
Yeah, he's been on my show. He's a good guy.
Yeah, I went down to his house last month, measured his house, check the shading and everything. It's a beautiful house on the beach. There's no tall trees blocking it, no tall buildings. He's got the most perfect location I've ever seen for putting up 100 solar panels. And he's doing it. He's going to the bank now, taking out the loan, he needs a new roof on the buildings anyhow, he said. That was the thing that motivated him. He needed a new roof. So I said, hey, we can do both at the same time. We'll just, add a new roof. Cost, and it'll even take a bank loan out for a new roof, and it'll happen to be solar panels, and it'll be 100 panels.
Well, when you're doing a new roof, Paul, you can put in solar shingles, amorphous silicon, as opposed to solar panels. And maybe I'm sure you've looked into that.
Yes, as a matter of fact, there was a big news item today that thin film solar panels are now more efficient than regular solar panels, because they absorb low light, they absorb light even in shadows, they get it from a better angle. That the thin film solar panel is the way to go, and that makes it less weight to put on your roof, and so people that have older houses will be able to put up thin film roofing cheaper, and it'll be better than a traditional solar panel. And
in California, of course, you also have the question of earthquakes. You don't want a whole bunch of solar panels on your roof in the middle of an earthquake, whereas the shingles are just shingles.
Yeah, thin film especially will be more like tin roof than ceramic panels or something like that.
They're asphalt. I mean, I was in Kevin, you may know where this is, in Bloomfield Hills near Detroit. About 10 years ago, I was in a place called Unisolar, where they made roofing shingles. And these roofing shingles look like regular asphalt roofing shingles, except they were solar. Kevin, you want to jump in on this? You got anything on solar to throw in?
Well, I did meet those folks from Solar Ovonics, right? We info-tabled next to them on Earth Day 2000, where I was on the National Mall. So we spent the whole weekend with those folks from Metro Detroit you're talking about, Harvey.
Yeah. That's when you have the, the Solar Olympics? They have the houses displayed on the mall?
Yeah, this was an Earth Day, and I think they did take part in those Solar Olympics, too. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I always thought that roofing... What's that?
I think same company was featured in a film. I think it was the Who Killed the Electric Car. They featured that company because
they also specialize
in batteries.
Well, it was Stanford Obshinsky, the great pioneer in photovoltaics, who was involved with that, and he also had one of the first electric cars. Of course, Thomas Edison really had the first electric car. That's how they were going to go in the first place, until the oil companies intervened. So, last week, yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Well, one of the points that Peter Matthews makes in why he wants to do it is he wants to replicate what Gandhi did with the salt tax in India. Peter actually wants to put 100 panels on just to see if he gets challenged, if he gets stopped, because then he wants to take it to court and do like Gandhi did, use it as an example of what we should be doing in order to break the salt tax, to break the solar tax. He wants to start this movement of people putting up 100 panels to push the envelope for solar and start a mass movement the way Gandhi did to break the salt tax, which broke the British control.
Well, he can only do that if he dresses like Gandhi and wears one of those, loincloths.
He was born in India, and I'm sure he'd be willing to dress like Gandhi.
Yeah, right. He's a good guy. I've had Peter Matthews on. We're talking with Paul Kangas from California, and Kevin Camps is still with us from Beyond Nuclear. Paul, we did have a disaster with solar in Nevada. The idiot Public Utilities Commission there has made it virtually impossible to proceed with solar to the extent that Solar City and other solar corporations have actually pulled out of Nevada. I'd love to see Elon Musk turn around and pull this billion-dollar battery factory he's building out of Nevada. That would be a nice little way to make a statement on, the politics of solar, don't you think?
No, we don't want Elon Musk closed down. We want it to win. But, see, the reason Nevada did it and the reason Arizona did the same thing is because of this group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has been going around the country trying to sabotage renewable energy. There's a big article about it in the Solar Times, written by Nancy Leon Vest, and it's called Feeding the Beast to Green the Planet? And it shows how the oil companies have set up these fake greenwashing groups to set up basically Shell Oil, help Shell Oil somehow harness the sun. My father in the 50s told me this would happen. He said, someday we'll use the sun, but before then the corporations will actually try and take over control of the sun. And I couldn't figure out why he would be talking about that in the 50s, but he was very far-seeing, I guess. So it's happening now because it's ALEC. And that article out of Solar Times by Nancy Leon Vest, I think it's the classic. You have to read that article to see how advanced these oil companies have gotten on this question of how they're going to beat us, they think. But inevitably we win. Inevitably we win.
We hope. We've got to keep the planet going long enough to win. The ALEC, of course, is sponsored by the Koch brothers. They are a front for the Koch brothers, as you know. So they are evil and doing as much as they can to destroy the Earth. I happen personally to believe the Koch brothers are extraterrestrials sent here from another planet to destroy the human race. But that's another show.
I have a copy of their birth certificate. Kevin. I can prove they're extraterrestrials.
Kevin,
there's a tie-in with the Koch brothers and the Wisconsin bill that would repeal the ban on new reactors. One of the lead proponents behind the bill is Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch brothers.
Yeah, right. Let's get you. We're getting close to the end of the show, Kevin. If you'll identify yourself and talk about your article real quick, and also give us your website, that'd be great, Kevin Camps.
Sure, yeah. So the article appears at ecowatch.com, and it's about how the Great Lakes and radioactive waste dumps don't mix. And I'm going to put it at the top of our homepage as well, which is beyondnuclear.org.
Great.
And people get a hold of you through that website. Paul Kangas, how do people get a hold of you? Where do you want people to go in terms of websites and stuff?
I have a YouTube site. It's my name, Paul 8, the number 8, the figure 8, Kangas, K-A-N-G-A-S. I put a 3-minute video up every day about what's going on. As a matter of fact, you will see new videos up that I shot right in the middle of the PUC meeting this morning in San Francisco. But I've got 6,000 videos up, mostly dealing with solar. And I also have a blog called 100% Solar. No, it's Solar 100% Blogspot. And people can get in touch with me through both of those also.
Okay, so now this is a big corner to turn here in California on solar. It does, you know, indicate that the foothold of the industry is pretty strong. I mean, California is 10% of the country. So I would assume that this is really considered a pretty big victory here. 15 cents a kilowatt hour ain't bad, really, to be able to get for solar. I'm not sure, and you got to double check, Paul, as to the terms of how it's paid. I know that in Southern California, in the LADWP district, they play games with it. They don't pay you right off the top, and they set it aside as a credit that you get, I think, when you maybe annually or when you move your house, something like that. So you need to take a look at that, if you would. And also, we need to really look
at that will be clarified in court. But I believe that what they were talking about today was 15 cents a kilowatt hour cash money on the barrel head.
Well, when? Is it immediate pay? I mean, is it on your monthly bill? What's the deal?
Monthly.
All right, well, you better double check that, because that's that was kind of a pain in the butt in Southern California. And I am all for the transition from solar panels to amorphous shingles, especially in areas that are prone to earthquakes. I mean, I think that's a big deal. And if amorphous now is, if the roofing shingle technology is now going to jump ahead of solar panels, I think that's a huge deal. You know, solar panels involve a lot of extraneous material that these roofing shingles do not. And I would suspect that a strong argument can be made that the amorphous, photovoltaic roofing shingles are going to be a better deal, both for the environment and for the economy. And we'll have to take a look at that. And I'd certainly be interested, Kevin and Paul, in your opinions on that as you take a deeper look.
The long-term goal here is to shut down the nukes in California using solar, the way Germany is shutting down all their nukes by 2021 using solar, wind, and hydro.
Well, yes, Kevin.
Another one is from one of our advisors, Stephen Strong at Solar Design Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts, glass that is solar PV generating. And so you can let the sunlight pass through the glass during the day, and it provides electricity at the same time. You don't need the lights on during the day because the sun's doing that. But then you can use that electricity once the sun goes down, and it was generated passing through your transparent glass. So the technologies for PV are just
great. Well, on that happy note, thank you both, guys. We'll be back again next week. Thank you, crew in New York, and we'll be back next week for another hour in Solartopia.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solar